Welcome to More Than One Thing with me, Athena Calderon, the podcast focused on non-traditional career paths, creative endeavors, and the ever-evasive multi-hyphenate. We live in a world today which encourages us to be the multifaceted humans that we are, though we're still subjected to antiquated pressures to follow a single path to success. But there is so much beauty to be found in our complexities, and I want to encourage you to embrace your full self. This is a podcast about taking the road less traveled to find your passion and purpose while navigating the hurdles and hoops we all jump through on this personal and creative journey. I'm your host, Athena Calderon, author, interior designer, chef, recipe developer, entertaining expert, creative director, stylist, product designer, storyteller, editor, and certified oversharer. Does that sound like an insanely long way to describe my career? Well, it is, and that's exactly why we're all here. Every week, I'll be sitting down with another multi-hyphenate who I admire deeply to talk through their struggles, vulnerabilities, and eventual successes throughout their long and winding journey to where they are now. Because it's in other stories, I believe, we can always see a little piece of ourselves. You might know today's guest, Reid Krakoff, as the mastermind behind the luxury powerhouse Coach. Or you might know him as a photographer or as the man who launched the era of the creative director. Then again, perhaps you know him as a judge and mentor for the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund. Or maybe you recognize the refined spaces he creates with his wife, interior designer Delphine Krakoff. Or maybe it's his knack for real estate showcased in his book, Houses That We Dreamt Of, that rings a bell. I mean, talk about more than one thing. More recently, Reid found himself at the helm of one of the most famous brands in the world, Tiffany. From 2017 to early 2021, he served as Chief Artistic Officer, the first ever in the brand's 183-year history. In this role, he had more responsibility than any creative figure has ever held at Tiffany. But it all started in Weston, Connecticut. Reid trained his eye early, at 5 years old, by flipping through his parents' book of Picasso posters and falling in love with the Mies van der Rohe chair. Is it any surprise that that little boy grew up to collect 20th century furniture? After studying at Parsons as a young designer, Reid worked briefly at Ralph Lauren before landing at Coach in 1996. He transformed the accessory brand into an international success, driving sales from $500 million to $4 billion. At Coach, Reid saw what no one else did, the need for accessible luxury. To the world of high fashion, this was a revolution. In 2009, Reid established his own namesake brand of ready-to-wear and accessories. His pieces were embraced on the red carpet and, of course, worn by Michelle Obama on the cover of Vogue. At Tiffany, Reid did what he does best, which was everything, jewelry, accessories, and all imagery. And in true multi-hyphenate style, he was overseeing the renovation of the Tiffany flagship on Fifth Avenue prior to his departure. I love how many creative disciplines Reid has accumulated over the years, each one informing the others, somehow blurring the line to become one. The things he loves become his work, and his work becomes the things he loves. And with that philosophy, I couldn't agree more. Reid Krakoff, welcome to More Than One Thing.
I am so unbelievably honored to have you here on More Than One Thing. And I just listed way more than 10 things that you do. And I'd love for you to kind of, in your own words, share, you know, what the trajectory of your life has been and how it has unfolded in a nonlinear way. And also like what being a multi-hyphenate means to you.
So thank you for that beautiful intro. When I think about my career and I think about you know, what I love to do and having the opportunity to do that every day. It's something that has really always driven what I do for my professional life and what I do for my personal life. So I've always had this combination of the two. I never thought about work as one thing and then my creative life as another thing. I've been super fortunate to be able to combine them. So when I think about sort of how my career has evolved and all the places I've been and who I've worked with, it's always been driven by this idea that there's no separation between your work life and your everyday life. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, that's really central to what's propelled me. I've really only thought about what I love and what I love to do and what I'm interested in, and really believed in that those are the things you'll be successful in. I mean, I think that's something I've learned over and over again, is that what you love and what you love is usually what you're good at. It's what you're successful in, because it's something you can't fake.
Was that always your perspective, though, or did it take some time for you to get there? How did you find your creative calling, so to speak?
What was really good, maybe it was, I would say it was difficult, but good, is that I was sort of, I had this blind faith that I should try everything. And, you know,
I love it.
I had parents that were super supportive and, you know, just said, well, if that's something you want to do, then you could figure out a way to do it, then go ahead. And so I went to Berkeley. I was midway through college and I was in Boston. And I said, you know what, I want to study music seriously. And I found out, if I tell you in the first week, it's probably sooner than that, that I was sort of the worst position at the best school. And it was violent. It was so obvious.
Wow. And you knew immediately.
I knew. I mean, the people that were successful, and it's funny, there are some musicians that were in my class that are still today performing. One of them performs with John McLaughlin and Mahavishnu Orchestra, you know, the best jazz bands on the planet. These kids were that good then, you know, and they went into the practice rooms and they literally would bring food and some beer or whatever. And they would just stay there for 2 days. And, you know, I just didn't have that discipline. I didn't have that love. And frankly, I didn't have the talent. I had the same experience when I studied at the School of Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Mm-hmm. It's when I was getting my bachelor's degree in liberal arts. And I was with really talented people. And again, I was okay, but I realized really quickly that I just wasn't, it was not something that I would be successful in. My father took me to lunch. I was in London visiting him when I was in college, and he took me to lunch at the Connaught. It's a fancy hotel with a very tailored and a bit uptight restaurant in it in those days. And we had lunch, and he looked around and he said, you know, you have to sell a lot of paintings to eat here. You know that, right?
Oh my goodness.
It was very impactful. It was very, my father is not with us anymore, is extremely funny. And said, you have a point there.
What, did you place judgment on yourself, or did you have shame, or were you able to just identify that, okay, this isn't for me. I've learned something. I will take this with me on my next journey and just move on?
After, I can't say that I was so resilient at the time. But I think quickly thereafter, usually it was a few years later, I definitely started to realize all these things were the same. And I could take things from what I learned in music and what I learned in art and what I learned in working in retail. I worked on Madison Avenue in stores when I went to Parsons just to make some money. All of it was, if you would let it be that, all of it was information that was useful and that helped me be the person I am today. So it was difficult, though. I mean, I had a kind of a, I would say positive, but somewhat negative quality that I would just throw myself into things full. This is what I'm going to do. And then, you know, a year later, it was like, well, I'm not particularly talented at that. Maybe it's not the right thing for me. So I kind of got it out of my system pretty early in my life. Basically, once I got out of college, out of Parsons, I kind of knew what I wanted to do.
And you studied fashion at Parsons?
I did. I interned actually at Anne Klein when I was there, which was amazing because I met someone who I admire to this day, Narcisa Rodriguez. really is the consummate designer. I was thinking about as the designer's designer. But standing next to him day after day, once again, I saw what I could not be. Like, I was never going to be that type of fashion designer. And I really saw that. You know, he's someone who drapes beautifully. He can cut a pattern. He sketches like a fine artist. He knows every aspect of clothing and the mechanics of pattern making and really everything that has to do with that topic. And I really saw that, wow, that is not the designer I can be. And it kind of culminated in the era of the creative director. And that really was the moment where I was like, this makes sense to me. It's marketing, it's design, it's imagery, it's interiors. There's a business piece to it for sure. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it was like everything that I had done and failed and done somewhat well in the past all kind of clicked together. And it was this funny set of skills that strangely I'd accumulated. And, you know, by the time I got to coach, it was something that was typical in fashion houses then to have a creative director. It's almost, you know, it was something that almost every brand had someone. So it was really suited to, I mean, I was really fortunate. It was really suited to what I was able to do.
Right. It's really interesting how learning what you weren't good at had just as much value, if not more value, than what you were good at, because it kind of led you to the creative direction role.
Definitely.
I will never forget when I was just about to start writing my design book. Your book had just come out, Houses That We Dreamt Of. And I remember reading the introduction that you and your wife wrote, and it was very succinct, and it, you know, was almost the opposite of how I write, because I tend to write way too much, but it said everything it needed to say, and it touched me so deeply. And there was a few lines that really I thought spoke not only to your design process in your own private homes, but it seems like it really is a reflection of how you live your life. At one point you wrote, with each new project, we begin down the path of an original narrative, which takes us in an entirely new direction. And it seems like throughout your life and throughout your career, that has kind of been a constant, that, you know, you go down one path and it takes you somewhere else, and you kind of go there willingly and discover something new about yourself, and you discover a new role or a new career. So I'd love for you to kind of talk a little bit about all of those kind of twists and turns a little bit.
I have to say it was a really illuminating process to do that book. It took about 5 years. But to your point, the idea of being open to what I call sort of a happy accident, or being open to things not progressing in the way you thought it would. You know, I always say, like, when you're taking a picture, usually the best pictures happen when everyone walks away from the camera and all of a sudden something perfect happens, and everyone always happens. Everyone says, don't move, because it's real. And, you know, when I take pictures, I always have a starting point, but I really don't truly have anything particular that I know it's going to be like. I just know that I want to start and let something happen. And that, if there's one thing that I can say throughout my career, and it's hard, it's a hard thing to give into, but you kind of have to give into that uncertainty and believe that it will work out. And, you know, that's something I think I got from my parents. It's definitely something I get from my wife, Delphine. But that ability to just know that, you know, okay, you're working on a collection of high jewelry, and guess what? All the stones that you designed into are unavailable, and you have to only pick anything. And not to be taken by that, but to realize that it doesn't really matter. And I truly believe that. I always say that, you know, I can kind of start anywhere on a project, a creative project. It's because it's always a combination of what you have to work with and what you do with it. And in that way, I always kind of can start anywhere. I don't really have if a fabric comes in the wrong color, it's something you learn to work with. And that is something I've learned from many people I've worked with, that never to panic and never to be so set in your ways and so dug in on a direction. Because especially in a commercial business like fashion, it's just not the way things work. So it's better to almost encourage those surprises and roadblocks and things like that. But that idea of just letting things kind of happen while you work is something that's just been a technique that I learned from people I work with. And year after year, it's getting easier. But I still have that, you know, I still have those moments where I think, I have no idea what I'm doing.
I mean, wow. I feel like that every day, but like, I'm just surprised with, you know, your pedigree that you still feel that way.
I do. I feel like not, I mean, last night I was thinking about something and I was like feeling like nothing I've done is very good. Actually, I don't know how I was thinking about one particular discipline. I'm like, how did I get to this point? And, you know, I think that challenging yourself in that way is what drives you, is what makes you, you know, not become complacent. It's what makes you want to know more, want to work with different people. You know, it makes you want to better yourself, I think. I mean, it's sort of a good news, bad news thing because you never truly appreciate it. I think most people aren't able to say like, wow, look what I've done. It's always, wow, how did I get here? And everyone knows that this is just, you know, somehow I got to this place. It never feels pure. I'm not sure anyone ever feels that. Maybe they do. I certainly don't.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think, like you said, I would be bored and complacent if I was just doing kind of one thing. And if I thought, you know, that I was, you know, the best at what I did. I think that being kind of curious and somewhat being a perfectionist and being hard on yourself, but also being open is also what keeps you hungry and driven and curious.
I mean, I think humility, as I've gotten older and as my career has gone on, I have to say that's the one thing that I've learned over and over and over again, is humility is so important. It's so important never to think that you've done it, that you've figured everything out, that you've reached a level that, you know, you don't have to be curious. You don't. And that's one of the things, my impatience, I think, and my sort of inability to sit in one place for very long, really well for what I do. What's really amazing, again, and it's something that I think only comes with time, is that if you let it, it all kind of builds on itself. It becomes this cumulative, I call it like a cultural map kind of. It's almost something that's intuitive. You just, if you continue to kind of work in a direction that interests you, it tends to all come together. So a campaign, a collection, a store interior, a collaboration, they all kind of feed each other. And for me, that's like when I'm happiest, you know, working.
How do you approach something when there's unknown? Like, you know, had you ever done fine jewelry before Tiffany? Do you ever feel overwhelmed? Like, how do you work through uncertainties?
That's a great question. It's something I think about a lot. I actually have a very simple and sort of fundamental way of doing it. I learn everything I can learn about what I'm working on. If it's high jewelry, and to answer your question, I've done a lot of sterling jewelry, a lot of gold jewelry, some like semi-precious stones, but never high jewelry. And first and foremost, I must say you need an amazing team. But it's just incredibly complex, incredibly expensive, and time-consuming discipline. And it's not to be taken lightly. I mean, you're talking about, this is serious. You're making things that may end up in museums, may end up in someone's family for 100 years, 200. I mean, there are really things that are different than when you're doing handbags. It's a different, I feel a different responsibility in a way. So first and foremost, you must have a team that complements you. And you also must be able to communicate with them in that language, though. So what I usually do is I just immerse myself entirely in history of, in construction, in gemology. I studied with our gemologist to really understand, at least to know how to communicate what I wanted, instead of saying a pale green stone, it's a Sabradorite, or it's a, you know, it's a green tourmaline, and this one's super expensive and this one's not. So for this piece, probably I'm looking for this. And, you know, that kind of thing I demand of myself. So I'm always kind of a geek in that way. Like, I want to know everything. I spent days and days and days going through the archives. I literally went through every single high jewelry book in Tiffany's history. I just put them, my assistant would Xerox them, and he would just put them on my desk every day. I'd look at a couple during lunch, during some other time. I have to see what other people are doing. Always, you have to understand the context. Always looking at auctions, always looking at the best dealers. just to form, I need to form a world that I understand how to operate in. Otherwise, I don't think I can be very successful.
Yeah, because you wouldn't hold the confidence too. It's almost like you need...
I would. And I wouldn't get the respect, I think, from the experts. But whenever I start something new, I love the moment where I don't know that much. And I try to maintain some of that because of, you don't want to be burdened by, don't do this, don't do that. One of the very first projects I did was the first high jewelry collection, first blue book. There was a concept that was essentially as if you had a sheet of diamond, one solid sheet that was 3 inches by 3 inches. And then it was cracked like the surface of a pond or something. And then those diamonds were linked together in a way you didn't see the fittings. So you had this fluid idea of irregular diamonds that would be supple and would drape and would contour to the body. And it's something that the gemologist, like, why would you want to do that? You're cutting all these perfectly good stones, super shallow and irregular cuts. And if it doesn't work, these are all, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with these.
Oh, gosh.
But I'm not sure someone who's done a lot of that would have asked for it. But I have to say they loved the challenge. And it turned into one of the most important pieces. But it took 6 months literally to get a 1 by 1 inch sample of these custom cut diamonds.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I'm going to go back and look at that. That sounds incredible. You really are an incredible communicator and collaborator, it seems, from working with so many large teams. Like you said, people above you, people below you, being at the helm, your marriage, your collaboration with your wife and all your homes. Is there any bit of information that you can kind of share about how best, because actually even just for me, but also for our listeners, because I sometimes feel as though I'm such a perfectionist. I have put myself up to such high standards and sometimes I micromanage other people how do you delegate and how do you find that you've been successful with working with large teams?
Such a good question, because it's fundamental to being able to sort of lift yourself out of doing everything. Like everyone who's a bit of a control freak, and I think you have a negative way of saying it, but I think you have to. You care deeply about what you put your name on and what you care deeply about the quality of the work, regardless of anything else. It matters to you personally. It's funny, I have someone I work with on my team who's had an issue a couple of years ago with delegating. And finally, I just forced them. I just said, you know what? You're not going on this trip. You're sending someone who works for you. And guess what's going to happen? Nothing. You will be fine. And you'll get to be in New York. And you'll do things that you need to do. And once he did it, it's funny, now he has no issue doing it. But I had the same issue early on. I tried to do everything. I need to prove I could do it. I can do anything. And invariably, it sinks you.
Yeah.
You can't be that good at everything, even if you have the time. And you don't. So what I've found is you have to build a team of people that you understand and they understand you. So developing a team that you believe in and that understand you and will tolerate you and all those good things, and who can say no to you, like they will say, forget it. And I know they mean it because I trust them and they have no ulterior motives and they just want to do the best work possible. So my whole strategy has been just, you have to build a team over time. And once you have people that you're comfortable with, you have to delegate. There's just no way around it. You won't be able to do everything as well as your team.
That's great advice. I'd love to talk a little bit about interior design and furniture, especially because I'm such a lover of interior design and I'm an interior designer, that I'd love to hear your process and how you found your way there.
I find it just part of the stuff that I'm interested in. You know, sometimes design and collecting and putting together sort of disparate things from different periods, it's kind of an intellectual game versus a physical thing in terms of having a room that actually looks like that. Other times it's when I'm working on an interior and Delphine and I do everything together. It's funny, it's really about a narrative and something that we can go back to, kind of a touchstone. And it's very subtle usually. Like when we did our house in East Hampton, La Sada, there was a very particular mood and attitude that we would never do it again, what we did there. There's a lot of early American furniture, a lot of Tiffany lamps, then it was mixed with Franck and some minimalists, and is very inspired by David Adler's homes that his sister did, Frances Elkins, who was one of the first people to use Franck in the United States and combine English furniture with Franck, with neoclassical, and that's what's interesting to me. It's almost like a challenge to do something different and to pair and create these dialogues between periods and styles that feels new. It's very similar to doing a collection. It's almost the same.
Yeah. I say similarly all the time that it's that friction, it's the tension that causes intrigue and curiosity. I read a quote that you said, it's about creating a dynamic between things you wouldn't normally put together. They interact and each one changes the space a little. And it's so true, because you suddenly put two pieces together that normally wouldn't be seen together. Yeah. And then there's a completely new dialogue that you build from. And then it just continues to become something else. And again, that idea is similar to your career. Like, it's very interesting the way your mind works, because how you design is a thread that goes throughout your whole personal life, design life, fashion life, career life.
That rhythm, it's a good way, the way you were describing it. For me, it's entirely about how you think about things. It's nothing to do with, in a funny way, it's less to do with the visual aspect of it. It's more to do with how you think of music, or how you think of art, or how you think of design, and how you approach it. And that's probably why jazz or fine art or fashion or any of these things are always complementary, for me at least, because it's all a way of approaching a creative problem, or let's say a creative project. And that way of thinking becomes extremely ingrained in your work. And I think that's how you kind of repeat this rhythm over and over again, to your point. You were talking about the two pieces of furniture you put together that people wouldn't expect or isn't the typical way. That's exactly like working on a brand. It's identical, because I always say with brands, they're like kind of like people. You know, they do certain things, they don't do other things, they sometimes surprise you, but usually they have some characteristics that are pretty consistent. And I think each time you add a surprising piece of furniture, a surprising collection into a brand, surprising campaign, it changes the whole. And then this thing, because it's kind of like a living, breathing thing, each time you add to it, it changes the shape. And you have to then reassess and say, okay, it's more, now it's a bit more edgy. We need to kind of counterbalance it with artisans and craftsmanship and heritage. And it's exactly the same as doing a room, the same as doing a collection, doing a brand. Mm. And a lot of it is driven by the scholarship aspect of it. Like, I'm super interested in why people made what they made during the time. Like, why did Art Deco happen in the late 20s in France? You know, what happened in the U.S. that caused this sort of muscular, kind of broad modernism? Why? You know, what was happening in the world? What was happening in terms of availability of materials, aesthetics, sentiment? And a lot of times things make their way into our interiors that really are more based on what's interesting. Nothing to do with we need a sofa or we need a table or, you know, something as functional as that. It's more just intellectually it makes an interesting contrast to the other.
Yeah. So often when we're designing our homes, because my husband and I are great collaborators as well, I'll be obsessed with something and I'll be searching and going down the rabbit hole and I find it. And he's like, but where's that going to go? I'm like, well, why does it even matter? Like, if there's something that your eye gravitates towards, if there's something that is missing in a space and this is going to fill that void, it almost doesn't matter what function it's going to have or where it's going to go, but it just, you know, completes the puzzle.
Totally. If you buy, you know, buy, collect, you are interested in what you love, you can't really go wrong, because by definition, it's something that's unique to you. And you know, I always tell people that always are asking, you know, what should I collect? Collect what's interesting or what you love, because you have to live with it. It's not, you know, it's not like investing in the stock market. These are things that you live with. You might, you know, they might become more valuable, they might become less valuable. And there's no point in really thinking too hard about it, unless your business is investing, which to some extent the design market has become much more like the contemporary art market than it used to be.
Yeah.
I said to someone, you know, what's good is not what's necessarily expensive. What's expensive is what's popular. It's not necessarily
yes.
a better way to say it. And you see that without getting into specifics.
Mm. So as you think back on your vast career and you navigated so many different kind of creative verticals, was there one significant hurdle that you faced that was really challenging for you, or something that you learned from, or that was a block that got in your way? If you could pinpoint what that might be and how you overcame it.
There's so many.
So many.
I think of a good one. One of the most, maybe the most obvious, is when I left Coach. I'd been there about 17 years, and I really realized that I just have nothing more to give. And I really do believe that designers, creative people, can only reinvent themselves so many times. And the reason I say that is because, you know, there's really, I can't think of one fashion brand that has been consistently on the leading edge, you know, that consistently been what fashion is about. It's just almost, I would say it's impossible. It can be, the quality of the work can grow and grow and grow, but in terms of relevance, it just doesn't work that way. You know, things, people get sick of this, they want that, and trends and things change. So I felt like I was at that point where I just had nothing left to say, and it was time for someone else. In addition, I had wanted to focus on my own brand. So the timing was really good, actually, to do that. And after some great success and some great failures, after about 6 years, I'd say, I decided to close my business. And that was tough. It was tough.
Yeah.
It was very difficult. It was very, it was everything you expect. It was embarrassing. It was somewhat humiliating. It was disappointing. I felt horrible for all the people that worked for me. It was really upsetting. It took a while to figure out what to do next. And, you know, but in the way I did really early in my career, even before I was in this business, when I was at school, I have no regrets. I did everything that I wanted. I did everything. I have no one to blame. I have no excuses, nothing. I did it the way I wanted to. And we had, as I said, we had some, you know, some great things happen. It just, I just felt like it was going to end badly. And I didn't feel good about going forward and taking new investments in my business. And so I may be one of the only designers who said no to an investment, but I actually said no.
That must have been really hard.
It was hard, but I have to say, I just knew it. The moment I made the decision, I felt better. I mean, of course, then I had to go through all the unwinding, which is not a fun experience for anyone, to close a business and to deal with everything that comes with that. But that being said, I was super fortunate to be in that position. We grew a luxury business that was important for a while. And, you know, we had the windows at Colette twice, and, you know, we were kind of everywhere you'd want to be. But again, it was great to do it, because I think had I never done it, I would have thought, you know, I wish I had my own brand. But the reality is I actually never wanted my own brand. It was more of a strategic decision with the Coach board and the Coach senior management that we needed to diversify at a time when a designer presence was really important in that market. You know, everyone was a personality. You know, every brand had a designer at the helm, essentially. And so really, that was the reason it happened. And you know, I'm incredibly grateful that I was supported, and no complaints. Don't have any misgivings about having done it. But it sucked to close, because it was very public. And I say very public. It was in the industry. And
yeah.
You know, I thought to myself, I'm never going to work again. You know, I did.
Yeah. Did you take a minute? Did you go quiet for a minute?
No, I didn't.
I love that.
You know, I did a big collaboration with Kohl's that I had started actually before. I had worked on some interior projects that Delphine and I were doing. And then pretty soon after, I ended up joining Tiffany, which is a place that since I was much, much younger, wanted to be part of the organization, but they just never really were organized in a way that would complement, you know, what I could bring to the organization. So it worked out, but it really was going back to what, truthfully, it was going back to what I knew I could do. And having to pick yourself up after failing in doing something that you're not known for. And, you know, it's tough, but at the end of the day, you're the only one that can, you know, that can move yourself forward. Nothing's going to, other than yourself. That self, you know, that self-belief is something that you just can't get away from. You need it in this business, especially. It's a tough business.
For sure. And on the flip side of my last question, if you were able to pinpoint one moment that was somewhat the catalyst, if there was a moment in your life that something shifted within when you suddenly stood in this place of I am rather than am I with a question mark?
As I think I mentioned earlier, I do go through that imposter syndrome. It happens to, I think, most creative people. It's what keeps you sharp.
Yes.
That's what gets you up early in the morning. It's what keeps you committed to, you know, sketching into the night, that you have to figure something out. So in terms of that, it's a fleeting thing in terms of when I feel like, you know, I'm in a place where this is a place that I feel good about. You know, I've been super fortunate to work with people that are nurturing type people and people that are good people at the core. I would say there was definitely a period where, and this is something I've experienced in every brand I've worked with, including my own. There's this period of gyrations and a lot of fits and starts and trial and error that you learn, but you probably say, well, that wasn't exactly right. You know, that was too youthful, or that was too edgy or too traditional. And you go through this, and if you're lucky enough, the administration, the business group lets you flail around, as I always say, a little bit. Because without that, you really never get anywhere. You know, it's sort of like no pain, no gain. It really is. You cannot figure these things out without putting your neck on the line. You just can't. So in those moments where I've had a few times in 25 years, I guess, where it feels almost like a designer described it to me as a camera focusing. You're focusing, it's slightly off, things come in and out. And there's a moment where it locks in and you totally understand what you're doing. You totally understand the path you're on. And that moment is it. And that moment I felt at Tiffany, really, it took about a couple of years. I definitely felt at Coach, I felt in my own brand. Even when I was, you know, creative director of Tommy, in those early days of what it meant to be creative director, there was a moment where things just kind of came into focus. I don't know how to describe it, where you do feel like you I understand what I'm doing. And I don't have to think about, you know, maybe we need to, the next campaign has to be a little more traditional because it's too young what we're doing now and the consumer doesn't get it. You don't have to think. And that magic, that's sort of the culmination of that single-mindedness, that commitment, that team effort that everyone has to contribute to, so that the people doing the windows, the people doing the interiors of the stores, the campaigns, everyone you're working with understands exactly what we're trying to do. And those moments, and again, probably four times in 25 years, have been the moment.
Well, that's a moment to celebrate.
Yeah.
Not to sit in your humbleness, but just to celebrate yourself.
But just feel good, because you feel for a moment at least that you're centered in what you're doing, and you feel for a moment that you have a little control over things that are really not controllable.
Absolutely. Well, I'm curious what advice that you would offer. You know, our world is so diverse and ever expanding, and there's so many different career paths for kind of our youth to engage in. And, you know, for so long, we were taught that we should choose one thing. And obviously yourself, myself, and so many other people that I've had on the podcast have chosen a different path and a bit more of a road less traveled. So I'm curious what advice you would give somebody who's younger and just, you know, doesn't know what they want to do because they see themselves as a creative with lots of different interests, how to start?
I mean, it's a perhaps unanswerable question because
I know.
well, there's a few things that are quite difficult, I think, today, and then I'll try to say something that's more encouraging. Everyone is exposed to everyone else who's doing something, and it's usually not really happening, but, you know, a better life, whether you're talking about Instagram or any kind of social media where people are showing that they're traveling here, they're doing this, they own that, they're collaborating with this person. It's difficult because there's so much of that information around that it can be super intimidating and discouraging, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I was coming up, it was much more about what you read and someone you knew, and there just wasn't this almost too many ways to express yourself and too many ways to, let's say, paths to go down. So the road less traveled is, you know, it's many, many, many roads at this point. But I think taking out the whole piece about we all have to make a living and it has to be reasonable, putting that aside just for a moment, the only thing that I know is true is that you have to do what you love. That's it. That's the only thing I know is true. You have to, because if you have success, it's the only way you're going to be happy. And you can be quite successful and not happy at all. I know quite a few people like that. Because, yeah, you know, once you have what you think you want, getting into the sort of there's no there conversation, you're no closer to being happy than you were before you had done that. So it's an amazing thing to do what you love, because you have that every day versus if I just do this, I'll have that. You know, if I just, even though I don't love doing this, it's where, you know, the jobs are. Or, and again, this is aside from all the things that are real and part of life that we all have to pay attention to. You really have to allow yourself to be genuine, because sometimes what you love is not what you're good at. Mm. My advice is to really try to understand yourself, try things as much as you can, put yourself out there to fail, because that's really when you find out how good you are. You know, I was an okay musician where I came from, and then I went to Berkeley and it was just like, there's no way this is going to happen. That was the way I learned, though. It was painful, but that was the way I learned that was just not how my life was going to be. And I love music. I still do. But I think that inner dialogue is the key to that, is to know yourself, know truly what you're good at. And if you don't, try a few things, you know, put yourself in a position where you really have to either do it or not. And then, do you love it? Life's too short, I think, to do something you don't love. And I'm talking really about creative people this moment, because not everyone's work life is their life. That's just not the way it is. You know, creative people like you, like me, your life is work and work is life. That's an incredibly fortunate place to be, I think.
It is.
And you really know inside you. You don't need anyone to tell you what you're good at or what you love. You're the only one who knows.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful advice. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your generosity and vulnerability. And in closing, I'd love to just ask how you continue to evolve your own passions and find new ones and fold them into your existing work.
So again, one of the most fortunate things is I get to do what I love. And part of that means pushing myself to do new things and continue to expand what's interesting to me and what's the language of the brands I'm working for. And what's interesting to me is to continue to push and push and push and push the boundaries of what this brand can be, or of collecting, or of interiors. It's like, well, nobody wants, there's a certain, I can think of a few certain movements in design right now that aren't very desirable. I mean, that's one of the things that happened because there's so much online now, is that everyone knows about everything. And, you know, whether it's, you know, Adnet or Genere or any of these people that are everywhere, you really want to move on from them and figure out new ways of doing things. So I'm always, always, always looking at what no one wants. I'm always looking at what's not popular. Mm. I'm always looking at I look at what I really don't like.
I love that. Okay. I'm going to go down the rabbit hole today of looking for things that I don't like.
It's usually a good exercise because we all get into a kind of a track creatively. And I think the only way to get out of it is just force yourself to do that. So for me, that's what keeps me interested is, you know, I love everything and nothing, my team says. And it's really true. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the right thing at the right time. That's it. I'm not a minimalist. I'm not Baroque in my taste, but I do love Tiffany Lamps, and I do love Joris Laharman and Mark Newson and Rhonda Rad. And, you know, I did a book on Ron and did a book on Matteo Bonetti, and I did a book on the Lalans. You know, they're totally different. You know, Lalan and Ron Arad couldn't be more different. That's what's exciting to me, is to try to move forward your own aesthetic, your own point of view. And that's, I think, the secret to keeping a brand fresh. You know, a lot of times when we're working on something, a new ring, a new collection, and I'll just put it on the table and don't say anything. I'll walk into another meeting and I'll just have it with me as if I carried it from another meeting, which sometimes I do. And if no one says anything, I usually know that it's probably not worth doing. But if everyone says something without me saying anything, it's always...
Oh, wow.
And it really points to this kind of intuitive nature of all this stuff. You know, it's not something you can describe how to do it, but you know it when you see it.
Yeah, because everyone has their own interpretation as well.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Reed. This was amazing. I hope we have the opportunity to see one another one day soon.
Fantastic.
I know how busy you are, so thank you for making the time.
My pleasure.
That was Reed Krieghoff, visionary, design devotee, and former chief artistic officer at Tiffany & Co. Thanks for tuning in to More Than One Thing. Stay tuned for new episodes on Wednesdays, and be sure to subscribe wherever you're listening now. If you enjoyed today's show, I would be so grateful if you could take a moment to rate and review us. And I'd also love your feedback. Which multi-hyphenates would you like to hear on the show? Send guest suggestions or any other feedback to morethanonethingpodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to check us out on our newly launched Instagram account, More Than One Thing Podcast. And you can find me personally on social @iSwoon. If you would like to receive the More Than One Thing newsletter, please head over to i-swoon.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Athena Calderone, and you've been listening to More Than One Thing.